Welcome to the Outer Lines Perspectives on Cycling, Volume 8. I'm your host, Steve Brunner. Our guest is four-time U.S. Pro Champion, Fred Rodriguez. Fred was born in Bogota, Colombia. He grew up in the L.A. area and now resides in California's Bay Area. He is one of only 12 U.S. stage winners of the Giro d'Italia. He now coaches, mentors, and resides over the Fast Freddy Foundation. Welcome, Freddy.
Hey, Steve. Nice to be here.
So you're the first one back after a little bit of a COVID trip up here. We had a hiatus of about almost a year and then getting this back on track. So glad to have you on board. And, you know, we go back a little bit. I've known you most of your career. You've done a lot of the events that my company and Medalist have promoted over the years. So take us right to jump into things. Take us right into your career, and then you took this unusual path, you know, looking back. You weren't with, I'd say, a group of Americans. You seemed to kind of carve out your own path during your career. Give us some perspective on that, and then why you did it. And I think things are a little bit different now, which we'll get to later in the podcast, but, you know, how Americans are absorbed into the Peloton over in Europe.
Yeah, I think it, I mean, of course it happened naturally. It wasn't something that was forced, something that was, we were, you know, I think my coach at the time was Renee Wenzel. He was a national team coach, and I stayed on board with them in my amateur career as I was working my ways up to national team until when I went pro with Saturn. And so that, you know, I always look back at the idea that now understanding more of the way of coaching and how to do it properly, you know, we were basically on this long-term development path, you know, even though we were in a way creating it at the moment. I was a typical kid, you know, I played tons of sports. I was cross country, swimming, soccer, surfing, cycling, you know, I was doing it all. I was very active. I was a kid, couldn't stay still. I was always involved in something. And, you know, as I got older, I started realizing that cycling was kind of the one that I really gravitated to, probably because my father was a cyclist and that kind of led me on that path. And I remember losing the soccer ball. I was like, oh, that was interesting, Dad. All of a sudden, I didn't sign up for soccer. And so it was all on purpose, you know, on the family side, it was my dad's passion. And I fell in love with it too. And as I got onto the national team, I started developing certain skills of being a one-day rider, really good at climbing, at sprinting, a little bit of everything. So as I graduated out of the juniors into the seniors, I wanted to go to the Olympics. So at the time it was Olympics were going to be I was going to miss the Barcelona Olympics. I was too young, but I did actually go with the team to go do some pre-races there. But so I had my sights set on 96. Little I learned as we were going through that process, that's the year that they decided to let pros in. So in 95, I was probably the number one ranked amateur rider, was actually second, you know, ranked within the pro points in the U.S., and I decided to go pro because I knew that there was no reason to stay amateur any longer. And I went pro with Saturn. And the goal there was that Renee felt that, you know, I needed a couple more years to develop my skills, you know, as a leader, as a winner, instead of going straight into the deep end in Europe where I was just going to be, you know, a grunter, you know, just working hard and trying to just survive. So it was a perfect development. I look at it, you know, if you ever looked at the long-term development model, I think the Canadian model that they've created for cycling is probably the best one I've seen. And they call that period of your career as learning to win. You know, so I was in that perfect environment where Saturn, tons of retired, or not retired, but older pros that were sharing their knowledge and kind of teaching me the direction where I wanted to go and kind of, you know, hold your horses. There's a process here. There's riders that are ready now. And so I took a second step into becoming more of a, not a domestique, but a young rider that was learning how to be competitive.
So question on those early days, 93, 94, 95, you know, that Skittles U.S. team, which I think competed in the Tour de Pont for a number of years. And it was just chock full looking back in hindsight. Full of these elite riders, Lance, Kevin Livingston, Bobby Julich, yourself, Tyler, you know, the list goes on and on. It Marty Jemison comes to mind. Really that era, it was kind of like the start of this golden era, you know, in road racing in many ways. Do you ever look back at that? And obviously you must have fond memories, and it was a little bit baptism by fire, certainly with a, you know, a 10 and 12 day stage race like Tour de Pont.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, that's kind of what really propelled that our generation to be, and so many good riders coming out of our generation is we had so much to offer us. We had Tour de Pont, we had West Virginia, we had, you know, the cloud, you know, if you're amateur, you can do US Pro, but you get to, you know, Lancaster, you can do so many other races. Not only that, as a national team, we're traveling to do Niedersachsen, Settimana, you know, Bergamasca, you know, so many races at a high caliber with pros. That was basically it was a perfect environment. I feel like we back then we had the finances, maybe the capability. It was maybe more affordable, but it allowed for the young riders to have and more riders to have access to this higher level of racing to develop. You know, because you can develop the engine, you can develop your cardiovascular, but developing the race, the racing IQ is a big part of it.
What was the seminal moment? And let's face it, the U.S. has not had a lot of great sprinters. I mean, you, Tyler Farah, Davis Finney, Ron Kiefel, given the right scenario. You know, if you look back at the history of sprinters, it's just, you know, U.S. has not been dominant in European races. There's certainly been a lot of great one-day riders, including, you know, not so recently, recently with Taylor Finney. So there are some really good one day riders, but like what I'd call pure sprinters. And then even where you made your niche as that super lead out guy, that last lead out guy that could also win, you know, in races like the Giro, you know, is there any history on why? Cause I think a lot of people want to know that. And then what was the seminal moment for you when you said, listen, I can compete with these guys, and, your generation, there had been already a gap from really Davis Finney to you, you know, at that point?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that, you know, I'm always asking myself that question when I talk to young riders and, why this gap in one day racers, I call us more classic riders, you know, depending if you're faster or stronger, you know, I've kind of fell into that genre of racing of a one day racer. We do have those riders, but I feel like because of our emphasis on the Tour de France yellow jersey, we tend to be focused so much on that we kind of are stuck in between Criterium racers and the yellow jersey. And we have this beautiful creature in the middle, which is, you know, Milan-Sanremo, Gent-Wevelgem, you know, Flanders, Roubaix, you know, Amstel Gold, you know, for the lighter guys, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, you know, the World Championships, you know, Philadelphia, Maryland Cycling Classic now that's coming out, all these races that are geared toward this one day racer, which is a balance of, you know, I always say that, you know, when you're racing, stage racing tends to favor physicality, which what I mean is like the stronger athlete most likely will win, while in one day racing, it's a combination of the collaboration of your team, the riders you have there, their style of racing, and how they collaborate together to win these one day races. So it's not just the strongest guy's going to win. Of course, we'll have to be strong, but we need a combination of a lot of strong riders to be able to win a Flanders, to win a Gent-Wevelgem, to win, you know, you want to have, you know, I always say in one day racing, you need numbers. You know, if you look at when I was on, you know, Domo Farm Fritz, Mape, Lotto, we always, our number one goal is like, how many guys can we get there in the finale? You know, the bigger the numbers, the more likely we were going to win. Most likely our team captain was going to win, but one of us most likely were right there to support him or to possibly win.
Talking to Chris Horner, I remember he made a comment outside of obviously his Vuelta win. He thought a finish in a major or even a semi-classic in the top 10 was equal to, you know, the podium sometimes of, you know, of lesser stage races. And I thought that was, for a stage racer at heart, like Chris, it was interesting. And I think one of the things he brought up was what a one-day event forces is some of the elements you were talking about. You got to have the strategy. You've got to know when to, you know, exert the right energy at the right time. And then, of course, you know, you got to have strength and you got to be smart and you got to have that punch at the end, most likely if it's coming down to a one-up sprint. So you were kind of a master at that. For as Americans go, I'd put you in the top three, certainly in that. What made Freddie Rodriguez, Freddie Rodriguez in, you know, and that makeup?
I mean, I think it's my background, partly, you know, if you think about, I'm Colombian. And I, even though Colombians are not known to be classics riders, you know, but I grew up in the U.S. and with that, a little bit more freedom of creativity, you know, I call it, you know, of racing. You know, you look at George in New York racing in Central Park. He talks about his creativity came from racing those kind of awkward, weird races with everybody thrown into, you know, and trying to figure it out. I've heard him talk to this about his son. You know, he calls it, you know, you got to be like a fly, be able to find that space, you know, in the peloton. And that's something I think that came really natural because of my upbringing and in a way, being able to learn in a very free environment, not very structured in a way, you know, even though I was still learning, but I was allowed to take a lot of risk in my learning of racing and creativity of coming up with how I was going to race. So as I developed, at the time, I didn't know what I was doing. Now that I'm researching it and kind of trying to figure out how to pass these ideas on, you know, it's comes into more of an ecological way of learning. You know, it's like a, you know, where you're more involved in letting people discover the process instead of telling them the process. And so I think I had a lot of that. So when I went to Europe at 16, I was thrown into this amazing peloton of top level juniors, and I felt fish out of water at first. But you know, I quickly started adapting quicker than my other teammates and understanding their flow, understanding what was needed. You know, it's like, you know, it's like a flock of birds, you know, it's like you need to be able to fit into that structure, not fight that structure. And that's something that I just became very natural to my personality.
And let's talk about the art of the lead out here. So it kind of dovetails a little bit against that. Good one day riders and certainly good sprinters make a lot of times those strong guys that you need for lead out guys. And you got to have top end speed, which you had. You get paid to do that. So the question here is, did you ever, you know, run into that situation where, man, I could have won that race, but my job was to lead out. And I'm sure you had a couple of those, maybe either in a tour, maybe it was, you know, in a lesser stage race, but did you ever question yourself a couple times, you know, through that process? And were you ever kind of put in a specific role, maybe because you were an American versus European?
I felt like I was, from my perspective, I felt like I was a very collaborative rider. And I got a lot of joy of winning off my teammates. You know, when Robbie won, when Tom Steele's won, when Zanini won off my wheel at Champs-Élysées, you know, I felt a lot of pride in being able to basically, it's, you know, like in, you know, another sport that I love, which is soccer, is like, you know, giving that assist, right? That perfect assist, you know, just putting the person in the right situation at the right time. And it's always different. So I felt a lot of pride in that. And I felt that I had a partly because of the things I just said, this understanding of flow and when to be, when not to be. Understanding space at the right time, you know, and something that it's really hard. And, you know, when I watch racing now, a lot of the kids are not getting it. And, you know, the typical thing you see in a lead out, and it's like they hit their 5K to go and they're not reading the race. And, you know, and they're like wondering why 2K to go, that they've been swamped, you know. And it's like, you know, it's like you got to understand how to read the flow of the race and when to be there and when not to be there. What type of rider, what kind of sprinter do you have? What kind of lead out team? How many are left? You know, you have to be able to think on the fly quickly and develop a solution on the moment. And it's switching all the time.
And that, as a lead out guy, I think a lot of people misunderstand, if they don't understand high level bike racing, the the utter importance of the lead out, the last two guys. I mean, if you get it wrong, it could go violently bad. If you get it right, it's probably a beautiful thing.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at it, really what's happening, there's probably 1,000 mistakes happening, but who's making less of them? And who gets to that last mistake at the last mistake at the right time? So, I mean, it's like, that's what kind of, you have to be uncomfortable in that situation, that a lot of things are not going exactly, but we're readjusting. And a lot of people can't do that, especially for more of a stage racer, that are, you know, things seem to line up a little more consistent. Not to say that it doesn't happen also, but it tends to be more consistent in lead outs, or even like one day racing. There's a lot more variables and a lot more chaos, and you just have to be comfortable in that chaos and understanding that you're doing better in that chaos than everybody else.
And I've heard you say basketball's one on one team versus another team, NFL one team versus another team. In a pro peloton, or in a, certainly at the pinnacle of the Giro or the Tour, it's one on 21 or one on 22 teams. That's an interesting dynamic that I don't think a lot of people really think about, but give us some perspective, because that was, I heard that from you, and you're right. The variables then go 20 times higher.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've learned this all through, I mean, I'm taking a lot of coaching education courses, but funny enough, it's in soccer, football in Europe from Spain. And so I'm learning all these ideas and, you know, the collaboration, the invasion, the space. And then I look at our sport, I'm like, wow, it's very similar, but we get to invade one space, which is a finish line, you know, and our field could be 260 kilometers and it's changing the whole time. And we have 150 competitors that are on 15 teams, and somehow we have to all collaborate. And when they teach you this, they're, you know, like your competitor is actually collaborating with you. So what they're doing, you need to play off, especially in cycling, where we collaborate to the point that sometimes we make coalitions and say, hey, listen, let's work together to accomplish this. Let's go on a breakaway together. Let's chase together. So many things where we're collaborating and some are not, some decide not to, or, you know, I bluff and I say, no, I'm not going to help because I'm not feeling good. And so many things are happening in the peloton that create energy and flow. And it's how to read that is something that takes time and takes somebody that, you know, hopefully has come from a very an environment that's allowed to explore and be creative. I feel Horner was one of those guys that got to, you know, because he came from a different kind of way of getting into the sport, was able to be creative in his development. And not enough riders are allowed that. They have to follow a more structural path.
A lot of emphasis on Mark Cavendish right now, going to Astana, and he's 37. He's at the end of his career. In your era, who do you think you thought was the fastest, just flat out, you know, 200 meter, last 200 meters? And I know that's a loaded question, because you're going to get stage racing, you're going to get long one day. So just pure speed, if you had to say, in the pro peloton in your event.
I mean, you know, it depends on what the race was, because that's the beauty about bike racing. It's like, you know, for a sprint in the Tour, and it's done correctly, and we drop them off in the right place, Robbie McEwen. If it's a perfect lead out and you have a train of six and you leave him off, you know, it could be, you know, at the time it was Pataki or even Cipollini, you know, those were the guys that, you know, so there were different sprinters, you know. Cipollini needed the perfect, I let him out and he didn't have the perfect lead out and it doesn't work for him. You know, he needs a train, you know. Robbie, we were more, you know, we had a team support, but we did a little more freelance. We floated within the last couple kilometers and dropped them off in the right space at the right time.
And so let's talk, changing gears here a little bit, to the coaching components. You know, you're starting to edge your way into that. You know, you've got a clothing company, Fast Freddy. You've had a foundation. You've done a lot with your brand, you know, and in a good way. You've done some things that I think off the bike, as well, with your foundation. Give us some insight on what you needed to do. You retired a little late, and we'll get to that in a second, but then what you knew you wanted and how you wanted to create a brand once you retired.
I think the whole developing of a brand was most likely had to do with the lack of not being able to go to college because of cycling. You know, I did a semester, you know, when I first graduated high school, and I realized it was going to be impossible to continue my education and try to be a top level rider. So I closed the books, but in my back of my mind, I kept studying. I fell in love with the ideas. Like, you know, when I retire, I want to get into the business of cycling. What can I do? How can I learn? To the point where for a while, Lee Steinberg was my agent. And part of that idea was, I want to learn from this guy. He's supposed to be one of the best agents in the world. And so I got a lot of insight from him. I was studying sport monopolies, why they were successful here in the U.S. I know, UCI tried to copy some of our American style of sports monopolies, but never worked. Just a little bit of that. I got the insight from Lee Steinberg, and his big reason was like, hey, Freddie, until you have a great union for the riders, you'll never have a great league. And that was basically, how we unify a world of riders is very difficult. So that's one of the things that he kind of, you know, led me in that path of understanding. And, you know, as I started going, you know, they started developing the idea of what my brand was going to be. My nickname was Fast Freddy. I wanted to have something involved in cycling. So as I started retiring, you know, I had different stages of my development all the way until about when I went to Europe. Then I had from Mapei all the way to Mapei, Domo, Soigneur Duval, which is basically Todd and Jay's team now, you know, where Indigo's working, up to finishing my career with Mark Surjohn at Lotto. And then I went into that next phase, which was like, what is Freddie going to do? You know, and so I went to Rock Racing for that idea of a new brand that, you know, that they were bringing to the sport, the new way of looking at cycling. And I was really interested in that. So I actually had a contract after 3 years to go into the business of the brand. Of course, they fell apart. And so then I had to kind of reevaluate what I was going to do. That's when I launched Fast Freddy Clothing, since that's what we were doing at Rock Racing, and led me to go to Exergy, eventually ending up at Jelly Belly to finally retire. And so it was a way to kind of extend my career, enjoy my career. I was definitely not as involved in my training, but towards the end of my career, because I was more involved in everything else I was learning from the sport. But I was still having fun. I was still mentoring some of the younger riders that were willing to hear me out and listen to me. And I got to win one more national championships, which was, you know, special. So I got four, which is the highest anyone's had.
And talk about that last win. You know, you were tied, I think, with Georgia at that time with three U.S. Pro Championships. And then to get that fourth at your age with that team, you know, or lack of team to some extent, someone might say. But I think talk about that. And that, once again, it's that old sage craftiness maybe that you applied into that last win.
Yeah, I mean, that just basically went down to understanding bike racing, understanding my competitors, and understanding my team, understanding the course, and coming up with an idea of what I wanted the race to be for me, and actually having a lot of team support from the young riders I had to maximize what we can do. So I really limited our efforts, you know, and not gambled, but focused on where I thought was going to be the pinnacle of the race, and it worked. It helped that, you know, everything fell into place. You know, Phil Guymon did the early attack, which perfectly solidified, you know, a chase, which meant no one was going to be attacking for the next, you know, last 15 kilometers of a race, which was exactly what I would have wanted. And it worked out that we caught him with a couple K to go. I was the fastest guy out of 7 or 8. And there you have it. So it was just, you know, and that comes back from all, I mean, could I have predicted it exactly the way, you know? No, it all those little moments happened, you know, and it was kind of like this, you know, intuitive, you know, ideas that you do as happen, as a race happens, right? That, you know, as you've been doing it for so long. And I was fit, but I wouldn't say I was in my top form.
How do you view your Palmares looking back? Four U.S. championships versus, let's say, a Giro stage win. Do you separate those? Do you look at one thing? This is the pinnacle of my career. How do you summarize your career?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at my best years are probably from 99 to 2005. You know, those were around there where I was really, really doing well. And, you know, another thing that for me was really important is once we started having kids, you know, when Aiden came along, and then Bella came along, and Max came along, you know, I definitely turned into a dad, you know, and I was like, that was a big focus for me and more of a family man. And so I was okay in the direction we were going.
Let's talk about your heritage a little bit here. You know, got some similarities to George and Cappy with Colombian heritage, but also being a Latino American and what that imprint has meant. Because I think both of you all have made a big mark for Latino Americans, you know, who aspire to be at a high level, you know, in cycling.
I mean, yeah, definitely. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, it's funny. Colombia is really the only, I mean, of course, there's a couple other countries in South America that are really in love with cycling. But I would say my fans in Colombia were almost as big as my fans in the U.S. because Colombia is there's such a love for cycling. And so I think that had a lot to do with it. So, you know, and I did grow up in L.A. with a huge community of Latin people, you know, like myself, writers, you know, same with George in New York. So I think it made it more comfortable for us to be in the sport because of that, you know, compared to maybe if I lived in Colorado or, you know, Wisconsin or something else where I would have been a little more probably not feeling as comfortable, you know.
So how do you project that legacy now, whether it's through your foundation or through your personality and where you can get out there and, you know, in this day where those voices are heard in a better light, you know, and the media is pronouncing that more, that's got to be a little liberating for you.
Yeah. So what I did is I started Fast Ready Foundation, and the goal there was to inspire young people from inner cities, from you know, demographics can't afford to really get into cycling or even ride a bike for fun, to get them into that. So our goal at the Fast Ready Foundation is just to, at the beginning, to get kids to learn how to ride a bike, to give them a bike, you know, build it with them and inspire them for that freedom of just going out there and exploring your neighborhood, going outside your neighborhood. And eventually if they love it, you know, they'd become a cyclist, and who knows where that takes them. But at least, you know, that was what I had as a kid, the bike. You know, in our generation, it was something that gave us freedom. I used it for transportation. I used it to go see my friends. I used to go to do everything, you know, and then later it became something that I did as a sport. So, you know, I developed that love for the bike before it was actually a sport, right? It was more of a ways to communicate, to get to a place to, you know, so that I think that's something we're missing right now with kids. And so that's where we try to help out.
And I've seen that. I've seen your love of both the bike and the kid kind of blend together. And it's kind of magical to watch how you interact with kids. I think you do a great job with that.
Thank you.
Let's switch one final gear into a final subject here and talk about the state of American racing and the state of American racers. And, you know, there's a lot of subjectivity right now going on the type of racing, from criteriums, which are the rage now compared to where maybe a decade ago or even when you were kind of at your apex, there were quite a few stage races. Tour California, US Pro Challenge, Missouri was blended in there, Georgia. There was a lot of stage racing that was going on. So that's one piece. And then the second half of that is for pipeline development and to really get groups of elite athletes, no matter what the discipline. And, you know, you could argue there's six major disciplines now with Gravel Worlds coming online and things like that, all the way down to track and BMX. You know, how do you view now looking back, and as someone who has got some acumen against this subject as both coach, been in different roles as a rider, you know, somewhat as a director, you've had this brand over here with clothing, you've been a lot of different areas, you know, within the industry and the sport. How do you view American, though secular to all that, and where we sit?
I feel like we're suffering right now when we look at where where the sport could be in for the future. And, you know, it's why, I mean, we could put blame wherever we want, but it's the reality that, especially with COVID, you know, kids are not getting on bikes. There's no racing for the kids, you know, with infrastructure on the roads. It's almost impossible for kids to want to ride a bike, or parents let them ride a bike. And so it's getting really hard to get kids to fall in love with a bike, you know? And so that's why what I'm saying, like, you know, we need to, you know, where we need to put our time and effort is not an ID, talent ID. It's, you know, development, you know, it's that joy of having fun on the bike and getting kids on a bike. So in 10 years, we have kids we can ID, you know, but if we're not getting kids on bikes and they're not falling in love with the bike and have this natural feeling of understanding of how to ride it, how to balance it, how to deal with traffic, you know, their vision, you know, and then you ask them, you know, at 15 and say, hey, here's a bike, you know, you're a great athlete, go do it. It takes a lot longer. And the pathway for a lot of people is too late. Not that it's too late. It's never too late. But it's going to take longer. And a lot of people are not willing to wait for that. So we need to start younger. We need to, you know, as in it's, and you know, the development is like, let's get kids on bikes. That's it. It's simple as that. You know, local, you know, the more local you can get, the better. So your community, you know, community rides, community, you know, even it's just right to school, right to, you know, that kind of stuff that we can, that's really what's going to really motivate the future. You know, it's like, I feel like right now there's a gap there, and we need to figure out how to bridge that gap. And it all, we have to be willing to invest for what's going to happen 15, 20 years from now. Because right now, I think we're trying to invest what's going to happen in the next 3 to 5 years. And basically that's already happened. In my perspective, it's already, those kids, we already know who they are. There's not a lot of them. We need a lot. You know, it's like, you know, there's a thing that, you know, in athlete development, they talk about, you know, as many as possible, as long as possible, you know, so we need to get into that mindset. And you know, it's like, how do we get more kids, you know, into it? And even then, I mean, you look at USA Soccer, we have more kids playing soccer in the US and any other country in the world, somehow we still are not developing the best. So even within that, as many as possible, as long as possible, also with how, you know, how we're doing this, you know, so you put those three things together and I think we could see the sport turn around, and we have to be patient, turn around in 15, 20 years.
Anything else you want to add?
No, that's it. I mean, that you know, this, I say that because I know that I will add a lot. So I have a lot to say. So I'm very passionate about, you know, development, especially with youth athletes. And I think, you know, I something that I've always kind of gravitated towards, you know, helping, you know, people that want to be helped, you know, and we need to look at that too. It's like, you know, look at talent and also look at who wants it, you know, who shows that passion, you know, because I was that kid, you know, I was that kid that maybe didn't show all the perfect things, but, you know, somebody saw something in me and was able to, you know, almost bet on me and say, hey, let me spend, I see this rough diamond. Let me help him. And, you know, that's all it takes sometimes. And, you know, because another saying that I've learned from all this coaching development I've done is like, we will most likely, you know, ID the wrong talent. So let's not try to do that as long as we can, because, you know, if we try to ID somebody at 12 years old, that might not be what really showcases at 22. So, you know, let's not do that. Let's not start. Let's, you know, if you see somebody that really loves it, let's just dedicate that time to as many of those as possible.
Well, I think you've been one of the great advocates that I've heard on the coaching and mentor side that says, listen, metrics, numbers are great. At the end of the day, you still got to get out on the road. You got to race, ride, and learn, you know, through that process. I think that's,
yeah. When you look at the metrics, I mean, I love numbers. I you know, before I was one of the first riders riding an SRM back on the national team in 92, I heart rate was huge. I love the numbers, but I always go back, you know, working with Indigo, that the numbers are there to teach us how we feel. You know, so I feel too many people are attracted to the number as something you follow. The number's the answer to the problem. So the problem is, what are you feeling? What are you doing? How are you doing it? And finding those solutions so you can get that good number, whatever it is, watts, heart rate, watts per kilo, you name it. Those are all great numbers, but they're all answers. It's like a speedometer. It's how fast are you going? Yeah, I see how fast you're going, but tell me the terrain. Tell me who you're with. You know, is it a tailwind? You know, all those kind of things. How you, you know, that's the problem.
Well, let's end it on a coaching note here. I heard you talk about Inigo more than 10 years ago, easily. And I don't think a lot of people know the connection you have with him. He's certainly been made topical with Pajikar over the last few years, but this guy's been, you know, on the forefront of a lot for a long time. Just give us some insight to where he was, where he is now, and what impact he's made on the overall sport and what impact he made on you and your career.
That was huge, because for me, it was like when I had Renee, we were working on these ideas. And I think from Renee came from more of a holistic, you know, from what he was taught from his dad. And we were already working on these ideas. And when I met Indigo and I started working with him, he kind of gave me the science behind why it worked, you know, the mitochondria, how our bodies work, how to maximize our efficiency, you know. And I started putting everything together and really falling in love with the science of it, because, you know, that's kind of what I was looking for. I was looking for is like, what's the solution to this problem? You know, I want to be better, and there has to be better ways to find a solution. Cause that was who I was. I was always willing to explore and, you know, almost take different paths, maybe the wrong path at times to find a better solution. You know, I was willing to take that risk, and Indigo was that to me at the beginning. And in a way, I didn't feel like I was taking a risk with him. I was like, this guy really knows the science behind how to train, you know, compared to just going out there and training hard. You know, a lot of our time was spent on actually when I needed to train easier. So he goes back to the zone two, and I already believed in that. So I was like, yeah, you're right. I agree. Now I know why I agree.
Well, Fred, thanks for being a guest here on the Outer Lines Perspective on Cycling. As always, it's been enjoyable, and wish you well on this next phase, which I know you're developing pretty rapidly on the coaching side and the rest of elements of your business.
Yeah, no, I'm excited to, you know, the next, you know, I'm going to say 5 to 10 years are going to be I'm still in my learning process of where I feel I could really make an impact for the sport. And that's why I'm kind of veering off in these different tangents like soccer and other things, you know, because I feel like they're adding to my toolbox of what I already know from cycling, and hopefully I come back as a, you know, and bring something to the sport and working with Indigo and still collaborating with him. So, you know, I'm putting all this together. So, you know, hopefully we can change the path. And my thing is not just for cycling, US cycling, but just in general that we, you know, we share this knowledge with everybody and let people enjoy our sport.
I wanted to pause there because that's where we'll end it. And I got a couple other questions. I usually put these literally on a, on a graphic. And so I've got four questions. All you have to do is answer them, and then I'll put them on the graphic. Favorite race in your career?
It has to be Philadelphia, just because of the you know, being American, being in national championships. It's a classic race, you know, the prestige it had for U.S. racers, you know, and what it was to me. Yeah.
Most memorable moment in your career?
Well, there was a lot, but I would have to say it was in cycling. My most memorable moment was probably winning the stage in the Giro, you know, just did the work that went into it, the lack of, you know, maybe support and belief, and just there's a lot on that day that wasn't, you know, before the moment was not working, and actually the belief and the support that I got from my team after that was amazing. So I learned a lot from that day, and I learned a lot about myself, and it was a great moment.
Craziest, most chaotic sprint you've been in?
God, I have to say it's probably, I actually crashed with Pataki at the Tour de Denmark. That shattered my collarbone. You know, we were flying it, you know, it was a downhill, slightly downhill sprint with a bunch of small islands. And we crashed into one of the islands. So we were just coming down like at 70 kilometers an hour. And he went down, I flew into him, and, you know, it was just in no time to think. It was just, you know, basically just flying in the air and shattering myself.
Fastest outright, forget about the race, just fastest guy on two wheels, past, present, future.
See, I think that has a lot to do with the race, you know, because, you know, you can look at Pataki, I look at as one of the fastest for a lead out, you know, even maybe better than Cipollini, for pure sprint. And, you know, of course, Cavendish or McEwen are right up there on that just acceleration that they have, you know, that short burst, you know, coming out of the pocket and accelerating. Those are two types of sprinters that are so different, but both as explosive and as, you know, as big.
And final question, you got one ride to take anywhere in the world. What would, you know, what's your favorite place or location to take that ride?
I mean, it still has to be Girona. I mean, I fell in love with that place. I go back every year if I can. Just riding from downtown Girona, going down towards the coast, these small farm roads out in the middle of nowhere that lead you out into this beautiful coastline, Costa Brava. You know, our dog was named Dosa. You know, Dosa de Mar was one of my favorite beaches. You know, we'd ride there all the time. You know, what Catalonia has and that Costa Brava is amazing. And they still keep it kind of secret compared, you know, most of the world doesn't know how beautiful it is.
I thought you were going to say somewhere in Italy, Lucca or wherever.
Como. No, Girona beats it. Definitely.
Good. All right, Fred. Thanks.
All right.
The Outer Line's perspective on cycling is produced by KOM Sports exclusively for The Outer Line. Executive producer is Steve Maxwell. Host is Steve Brunner. Editor is Keegan Brunner. This podcast can be found on most popular platforms. For more information, go to the Outer Line newsletter and subscribe there, or go to komsports.com and look for podcasts. Thank you.